welcome Tri-County Schools and Iowa Grant. Let's have the Tri-County School students please stand first. Thank you for participating. You may be seated. And we have students from Iowa Grant. Would they stand, please? And welcome to you also, and you may be seated. The students are here with the national prize-winning program called Portwood Class that the State Bar and the Supreme Court sponsor. Each of the students and their classes have received information about the case we're about to hear, and may have had counsel come in and talk about the case. And you all will meet with retired Chief Justice Day at the conclusion of this case, and any other persons here who wish to attend that session are cordially welcome. I would like to now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. Besides him is an empty chair, but ordinarily Justice John Wilcox is seated there, but he is not participating in this case. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage, and to his left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to the far left, Justice David Prosser. With these introductions made, we will now call the second case for the December sitting, 96-2559, Stephen Sharp versus Case Corporation. Mr. Weber, you have an introduction.
Yes, thank you. I'm Ralph Weber here this morning for Case Corporation, and I wish to introduce to the court Mr. Andrew Fry, who will be arguing to the court. Mr. Fry has been admitted pro hoc vice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fry, you represent Case Corporation.
Right. And thank your honors for allowing me to appear pro hoc this morning in this case. This case involves basically three sets of issues. First of all, issues involving whether this accident which occurred in Argonne to an Argonne resident that involved a product manufactured in Wisconsin should be governed by Argonne or Wisconsin law. Secondly, whether the verdicts in this case were so inconsistent as to require a new trial. And thirdly, whether punitive damages were appropriately imposed on the defendant in this case. Now, I'd like to pass on the inconsistent verdicts and rely on the brief and focus this morning first on punitive damages and then on the choice of the law. Start with punitive damages, even though they involve only a fraction of the total judgment, because of the serious stigmatizing and reputational effect that the imposition of punitive damages has and the importance the case of being vindicated against the charge that essentially was leveled against it in the jury's award of punitive damages. Now, this court has made clear in reviewing punitive damages that the question whether the issue was properly submitted to the jury, the standard of review is de novo. This is designed, I think, to recognize the very same factor that motivates me to start with punitive damages, that there's a special importance to making sure that when punitive damages are imposed, they are warranted. A related consideration to that is that the standard of proof for punitive damages in this state is clear and convincing evidence. We're not satisfied that on balance the evidence tends to support the existence of punishable conduct. We require that it be clearly and convincingly supported before the defendant may be punished. And the third protective factor is the definition of punishable conduct, which is not simply that you've done something wrong, not simply that you failed to take due care, and not even recklessness alone, but a conscious action in deliberate disregard, and knowing disregard of a substantial risk of serious harm to the plaintiff. Now, this case, I respectfully submit, does not come close to satisfying that standard, or certainly it doesn't come close at all, let alone clearly and convincingly on the evidence of trial. Now, what is the evidence here? And keep in mind that the jury found that the product was not defective in this case, the tractor. Over the course of 20 years prior to the unfortunate accident that befell Mr. Sharp, there were some 87,000 of these 70 series tractors in use.
Counsel, before you get to the facts, you've left now the standard of review, and I have a question regarding that. The Court of Appeals referenced a couple of our cases on the issue of standard of review for punitive cases, for punitive damages. They referenced the Maxi case, I think, that says the award must be upheld if there is any evidence from which the jury could have reasonably concluded that the plaintiff met the burden of proof. They cited our relatively recent Weiss case that says we are required to search for evidence to sustain the verdict and draw those reasonable inferences. And then there was, I remember, a Steinberg-Holmes case within the last couple of years where we said on punitive damages that we won't disturb it, the determination, unless it's clearly excessive. So how do all of those kinds of phrases tie into clear and convincing, particularly the Maxi case? The award must be upheld if there's any evidence from which the jury could have reasonably concluded.
There are two separate questions here. I think we were relying on the Steinberg-Holmes case, the proposition that the review is de novo. Now, if you ask me, what exactly does that mean? I mean, obviously, if there is a dispute in the evidence from which the jury could reasonably conclude one way or another, it's not the function of this court to disturb that finding, and we are not asking for that. But I think there is a somewhat heightened protective concern that this court has recognized in this area. Now, the specific question you ask is, how do you handle clearly convincing evidence?
With regard to the Maxi standard, that the award must be upheld if there's any evidence from which the jury could have reasonably concluded.
I don't believe that is a correct or even a constitutionally permissible standard. Even under the federal constitution. If you step back for a minute and think about a criminal case where the burden of proof is it has to be established beyond a reasonable doubt, clear and convincing is an intermediate standard between reasonable doubt and preponderance. The question you ask yourself in that case is not whether there's any evidence from which a jury could return a verdict, but whether there is any evidence from which the jury could find, a reasonable jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt. So you must, in your standard of review, if the protection of the clear and convincing evidence standard is to mean anything, you must incorporate that in your standard of review. So the question you are asking is there evidence, and I'm willing to accept any evidence, from which a jury could conclude that the wrongful state of mind on the part of Case was clearly and convincingly established. Now, another thing about any evidence is I don't believe you can take a single piece of evidence in isolation from the totality. So if there are pieces of evidence that are essentially uncontested, undisputed, you must weigh that in determining whether the jury could find the evidence of wrongful state of mind clear and convincing. Now, in this case, I don't really think it matters, and I said that by way of introduction, but in my view, there is nothing in this case, there is not any evidence in this case that would allow a rational jury to conclude at all, let alone clearly convincingly. The case was aware of the substantial danger associated with its product, either the product design itself or the warnings of the product, and consciously chose not to do anything about it. Now, at the end of the day, the evidence about awareness on Case's part of any kind of problem comes down to two incidents that were before the jury. A farmer named Jupe, who claimed that even when he turned his pulled his PTO lever all the way back to the off position. He had a chronic problem that the clutch would not fully disengage and that it would still turn. And there was actually a dispute about whether who was responsible for fixing this. This, he said to somebody called the block man, who's a local representative of Case, there's no indication that anybody in Case management had any awareness of this problem, but more to the point, this problem is not like the problem that caused Mr. Sharp's accident. Then we have the Jones incident. And in the Jones incident, the claim again was that the lever had been pulled all the way back and that Mr. Jones was injured when the machine started up, despite the fact that the lever was in the off position. The Case responded to that by sending their safety director down twice to Tennessee, I think it was, where the accident occurred, by testing Mr. Jones's tractor. And the safety director concluded he could not get it to do what Mr. Jones said had done. And he concluded that this was not, in fact, what happened, and that there was not, in fact, a problem. Now, if you had the kind of problem that you could say the company was culpably guilty, punishably guilty of disregarding, you would think you would not have 20 years, 87,000 units, two isolated and apparently distinguishable incidents. The fact of the matter is that if you are going to maintain any distinction between the conduct that gives rise to liability, and I seriously doubt whether there should have been, whether there was anything that even created a duty to warn arguably or did anything except confirm the case, that there is not a problem out there of this kind.
Well, counsel, with all due respect, I understand the record indicates not only a Farmer Jones had a problem with that PTO that he reported, but there was also a Minnesota farmer, Jupe, who talked about the problem. There was another Minnesota farmer, Peterson, who talked about self starts. A Minnesota farmer, Pemberton,
right,
when who called Case's president and sent a letter to them, and yet Case never, it's undisputed, I take it, that at least with respect to this series, they never sent out a warning about this.
I'm not sure that there's any record, certainly at the time of the Sharp incident, but I have to point out that both Peterson and Pemberton, it is undisputed that Case did not know about their alleged problem until after Mr. Sharp's accident.
Oh, I see.
So I do not see how you could punish Case for, you know, for not being prescient. That really would be...
That was Peterson, who? Peterson and who?
Pemberton.
Thank you.
There were two incidents, Jupe and Jones. And one other thing that I want to say about those incidents before I move on to the choice of law issue is that they both involve claims that the lever had been pulled all the way back into a disengaged position, and nevertheless, the machine was starting. That is not the problem that Mr. Sharp encountered. The problem that he encountered was that it was up on the ramp. The lever had not been pulled all the way back, and the problem was that he might have thought it had gone all the way back. So it was really a different problem. Now, we can argue how different it was, but I guess I have to step back and say, unless we're going to say in this state that the slightest mistake that in retrospect you think a manufacturer made is enough basis for imposing punitive damages, unless you're going to empty the standard for punitive damages of any meaning, this is not a case for punitive damages.
Well, did Case take any steps with respect to this particular device to warn users of the potential problem?
Well, let me say this. There were warnings on the tractor. There was
right.
a dispute about whether the warnings were adequate. The warning said turn off.
The reason I ask counsel is because the verdict, I think the verdict can be read to say anyway that the reason the jury found against you was because of your failure to warn.
Well, there's a problem with that, which is that... let me back up for a minute before I get off this point onto what the verdict meant. There was, in Case's opinion, nothing to warn about. this phenomenon that plaintiffs described the accident to was not one that they were seeing happening. They were never able to confirm that this risk of self-starting or so on existed. So when you say they didn't do anything to warn about it, my first argument on, we're talking now about the sufficiency of the evidence to establish punitive liability. My first argument is, where is the basis in the record, the clear and convincing?
What about Mickey Jones?
Well, they sent somebody down there to investigate it twice. He tested the Jones tractor, he ran 36 tests on it to see if he could bring about the phenomenon. Now, it may be that the jury at the end of the day could believe that Jones was telling the truth and that despite the tests that Mr. Hartman ran, this problem did exist. But there is no, remember, there has to be a conscious disregard, a conscious wrongdoing on the part of Case. It doesn't have to be an intention to harm. It could be conscious indifference. But conscious indifference. Now, conscious requires that somebody at Case concluded that, yes, there is a problem, but no, we're not going to do anything about it. By the way, a self-destructive thing for them to conclude, because if there is such a problem and it is dangerous, it seems to me they are exposing themselves to liability by not sending out a warning. Now, the warning they would have sent out would be, look, you know, we really mean it. Don't, you know, when we say turn off the tractor, we really mean turn off the tractor before you get down and work on it. But you have to step back. The point is that you need to maintain a gap. Punitive damages are not for every case in which there is liability in tort. Punitive damages are meant to be reserved for the exceptional case in which you have aggravated form of wrongdoing on the part of the defendant. And, you know, in all honesty, you simply do not have the kind of any evidence that would support conscious indifference to the safety of the users. So our position is, obviously the Court of Appeals and Judge Miller disagreed with my view, but I don't think this is a close case on that issue. And I've seen a lot of punitive damages cases in my career, and this is one of the weakest I've ever seen.
Mr. Fry, let me ask you a concern that I have in regard to punitive damages. You've talked about conscious disregard. Some of our cases talk about reckless disregard. The verdict question itself was framed in terms of, was the conduct of Case Corporation outrageous? And 11 of the 12 jurors answered yes, it was. Do you see any difference between conscious disregard, reckless disregard, and outrageous conduct?
Well, I would think that if you didn't at least have conscious disregard, the conclusion that the conduct was outrageous would be unjustified. So I think outrageous may be tougher to mean. I'm not sure. The problem with outrageous is it's a relatively contentless term, and I think the court, in explaining what kind of conduct subjects an actor to punitive damages, has tried to give it a little more meat, and the meat that it's given is to talk in terms of either intentional wrongdoing, malice, or a reckless indifference that's manifested through a conscious disregard.
Did they give the standard?
Conscious action and disregard of the...
Sorry, counsel. Did they give the standard pattern jury instruction on punitive damages?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay.
Was there any objection to the framing of the question, question number 18? Did anybody object to the term outrageous?
Not that I know, but I have to say that I don't wish to be understood for a moment as suggesting that Case's conduct could fairly be characterized as outrageous.
But that's a shorthand used in the Wisconsin cases to describe reckless conduct. And I don't, they use the pattern in jury instructions, but I have to look at it to see. He defined outrageous to mean reckless disregard.
I believe your task would be to ask yourself whether on this evidence a reasonable jury could find reckless disregard clearly and convincingly established.
So you're not objecting to the verdict question, and you're not objecting
that's
to the
not,
instructions.
That's
you're
not.
You're objecting to the sufficiency of the evidence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In other words, your objection goes to whether or not the judge should have submitted the question on punitive damages to the jury to begin with. Is that correct?
The judge should not have submitted the question, or I don't know, in the Wisconsin practice, the answer should have been changed on that. That's our position, yes. Now, let me turn then to the choice of law questions. And as you know, there are several issues, but the principal issues are whether the Argonne statute of repose and the Argonne cap on non-economic damages should be applied in this case. Now,
counsel, what is the Argonne law on repose?
Argonne law is...
We may not have to fuss about whether it's applicable.
Argonne statute says that a suit has to be brought within 8 years of the date of first sale or first purchase of the product. And it further states in defining what constitutes a product liability action to which the statute of repose applies, that applies to any failure to warn. Now, there is a question raised as to whether, and I guess I should get back to Justice Babbage's question about what the verdict on question five meant. I think you interpreted the verdict to mean that the jury found a breach of a post-sale duty to warn.
It's a double question. Is that the one that has both design and notice in it?
Right. What the question said was that they had to find that there was a defect at the time of manufacture.
The question I asked, did Case Corporation have a duty to issue post-sale warnings on the 1970 Agri King tractor at some point after 1972, but before August 22, 1992? Is that the question we're dealing with?
Right, but you need to look at Instruction 3242, which is at page 846 of our appendix, to see that it says at the top of the page, a manufacturer may have a post-sale duty to warn ultimate consumers who can be readily identified or traced when a defect which originated at the time the product was manufactured and was unforeseeable at the point of sale was discovered. Now, the jury found there was no defect in this case. So that is the basis of our contention that there is still an inconsistency, and I think there is, you know, we don't know what the jury did. We can't ask the jury what it did, but I think there's a very good possibility that it couldn't agree and it compromised. Here.
When you say that they found no defect, as I understand it, they found no strict liability in tort, but that they found that there was a breach of ordinary negligence. So under ordinary negligence, and they answered the question.
Yes, and in effect, they found not A, but yes, A and B.
Not strict liability, but ordinary negligence.
Right, and we've argued in our brief, and I would have thought, given what strict liability is about, that you could not have a verdict. This is the Brighton issue, whether Brighton should be overruled. In my opinion, you cannot have a verdict that says somebody was negligent. And the negligence, after all, has to be causative of the accident. And at the same time, have a verdict that the product was not unreasonably dangerous. So they were negligent in designing it, but it was not unreasonably dangerous. They were negligent in warning, failing to warn about it, but it was not unreasonably dangerous in terms of the warnings it carried. How can those two things coexist? They cannot coexist. And that the rule that says that they can has been much criticized.
But counsel, I'm aware of that criticism, but I can certainly conceive of a product that when it leaves the company, it is not in a defective condition. They have adhered to all reasonable care in manufacturing that. But then subsequently, either through wear or whatever, it comes to the attention of the manufacturer that there's a problem.
Right.
And at that point, a duty to warn may or may not arise.
Right.
And here, arguably, at least the plaintiffs argue that the duty
is.
Why is that inconsistent?
I think the law is not inconsistent. I don't think there's a problem with the law. I think it may be that the instructions were unduly favorable to Case in this instance. That is, you could, the words at the time of original manufacture has to be a defect at the time of original manufacture. Now, defect includes a failure to warn. You may not learn that the product was defective at the time of original manufacture until later. But, you know, I think that that could have been worded better. I don't think that that's our problem. And the problem is not, the problem is that the jury came back with verdicts that, given what they were told, are inconsistent. Is the product defective? Oh, no. Is the case negligent? Yes. Those two things, in my opinion, cannot coexist. Was the product defective at the time of manufacture? No. Was it defective at the time of manufacture? Question five, so that there was a false warranty. Yes.
Make sure you speak up. I'm having difficulty hearing.
Excuse me?
Make sure you speak up, please.
Oh, I'm sorry if you're not. Usually people don't accuse me of not speaking up.
Speaking up, what about your Erickson case? Doesn't that suggest that maybe there really isn't a conflict here, that the jury found you negligent of the post-sale duty to warn, that the statute of repose kicks in with regard to, you know,
assuming you were to find that the verdicts are not inconsistent, the Erickson, which is a separate problem, but assuming you were to find that this verdict reliably found a breach of the post-sale duty to warn, the Erickson case is a case about active negligence. That is, things were done by the manufacturer. The manufacturer was asked how many hours of use until this has to be serviced, and they gave affirmative misinformation at that time. So the charge was negligence, but it was a negligence separate from the sale of the product. And Erickson said, in that kind of case, you can't hide behind the statute of repose. This is a different case, because here the question is, did the product contain a hazard that should have been warned against? You only learned about it later. Now, I begin by saying that when the Argonne statute, subsection 2, I think it is, says any failure to warn is covered by the statute of repose, that what you're talking about falls within any failure to warn. Now, the Sealy case, which is a later Argonne case, I believe, says that the question, they are not expressing an opinion on that question. Say that in a footnote on whether a breach of the post-sale duty to warn. So it seems to me what this court needs to do is first decide whether, you would decide whether there is a conflict or not. But I think the rational way to deal with it when you're uncertain, when on its face there appears to be an inconsistent rule of law, but you're not sure that that's actually the rule that Argonne would follow, is to decide whether Argonne law should apply, because if Wisconsin law applies, you don't have to worry about it. If you decide that Argonne law should apply, then the question is, well, what do you do next? Now, you can either try to guess what Argonne law is, and we think that we had cited to you every other place that this question has come up. It's been held that the statute of repose encompasses post-sale, breach of a post-sale duty to warn. We aren't sure in Argonne, maybe you should certify the question.
Is the current status of the damage cap, the current status of the law in Oregon, that it's unconstitutional?
Well, that's a nice question. You have a statute, you have a decision of the Court of Appeals on which review has been granted. It seems to me that's an easy one for you. If Argonne law would apply, just wait a little while and you'll find out what Argonne law is.
My question, though, was, I think, an easy one for you. And that is the current status of the law in Oregon that the economic cap is unconstitutional?
I will say that I called an Argonne lawyer of my acquaintance and asked this question, and what she told me was the trial courts are not applying the cap. But there is a major difference between doing that in Argonne.
Counsel, according to your brief, this case was argued in the Oregon Supreme Court, if I understand, on November 5th, 1997. Is that right? And no decision has been rendered
correct yet.
Is that right?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay.
I just wanted to make the point that we can't appeal to the Argonne Supreme Court from your decision. All those folks in Argonne can. Now, maybe by the time you render your decision, the Argonne Supreme Court will have decided the question. But it seems to me that if it is your duty under Wisconsin choice of law principles to apply Argonne law, then you ought to wait to find out what the Argonne Supreme Court has to say about this. And on the
counsel, thank you. And you
thank
have
you.
5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Hildebrand.
Your Honors, it is my privilege to introduce Attorney William Manning of the Minnesota Bar, who tried this case, and he will be presenting the argument with me at the council table as Howard Ornstein, who assisted in the preparation of the brief. Both have been admitted to this court for purposes of this case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Mr. Manning, you represent Stephen Sharp.
Stephen Sharp and Mr. and Mrs. Sharp, Your Honor. Thank you very much. May it please the court. As to the choice of law issue, there are three separate and distinct reasons why Stephen Sharp should prevail on that issue alone, and I will then move to inconsistent verdict and close with punitive damages. There is absolutely no conflict in laws between Wisconsin and Oregon on the issue of post-sale duty to warn. Erickson decision, the 1987 decision of the Oregon Supreme Court, thoroughly analyzes post-sale duty issue in Oregon. And a finding by a jury that there has been a post-sale duty to warn breach completely takes that case out of any governance by the 8-year statute of repose in Oregon. Hence, Stephen Sharp recovers in Wisconsin on question number 5 alone under the Kozlowski decision on post-sale duty to warn, and Stephen Sharp would recover in Oregon under the Erickson decision.
Well, counsel, in footnote 2 of your opponent's brief, he answers you. And in that second paragraph, he states that this is an open question because, quote, the Oregon court subsequently stated that it is an open question, unresolved by Erickson, whether the product liability statute of repose can be avoided by pleading a negligent, continuing failure to warn consumers.
Your Honor, I don't believe on a review, and a detailed review as I've done of the Erickson decision and a detailed review of the Seeley decision in 1990, that all the Seeley decision did was it was on summary judgment, and summary judgment was granted because it was inadequately pled. And so there's language in Seeley that is quoted in that footnote by opposing counsel that I believe leads to that confusion, and I believe it's confusion, but on a detailed review of Erickson, there is no question that there is liability in Oregon for post-sale duty to warn for both affirmative acts as well as omissions, which is the language of the Erickson court. So I don't believe, Your Honor, that there is lack of clarity in Oregon.
Are we free to interpret Erickson that way?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Counsel suggests we certify the question.
Your Honor, I've not heard of a procedure of one state court certifying the question to another state court, so I'm not quite positive of the procedure that's suggested.
It's provided in one of our statutes. It's provided in
82108, is it?
No.
All I would say, Your Honor, is I don't believe that that level of confusion exists at all, and I believe the Erickson decision is very clear, read in conjunction with the Seeley decision, that a post-sale finding is alive and well in Oregon and takes it out of the 8-year statute of repose, without question.
Did anyone ask for a certification of this question earlier?
No, Your Honor, there's no request for that earlier. That is the first reason, as I've articulated, as to why Stephen Sharp should prevail on the choice of law issue. The second reason that Stephen Sharp should prevail on the choice of law issue is that Leverance and Beard are sound decisions and decisions that should be upheld by this court if this court goes that far to even analyze Leverance and Beard after looking at the Erickson decision. And as you know, we strongly suggest that the court does not need to look at Leverance and Beard. But if the court does, they are sound decisions. What they say is that we will look to legislature as to what the Wisconsin legislature meant by the words statute of limitation when they used them in the borrowing statute. We will not look to a foreign state, such as Tennessee or Minnesota, to see how they interpret it. And we will not read in extra time-limiting provisions into the borrowing statute that are not there. And so in those decisions, Beard and Leverance, they refuse to read in statutes of repose. But this court in Scott in 1990, the Court of Appeals in Johnson in 1993, and in Tim, and in Garden, where there were other time-limiting provisions, such as tolling provisions, that were attempting to be read in to the borrowing statute, it has always been consistent by courts in this state to say, no, we will not read something extra in to the statute. Now, an argument is made here by Case, that there was a floodgates issue, and that, in fact, plaintiffs from all over the country will come to sue manufacturers in Wisconsin. And when we responded to that argument in our brief, in their reply brief, they had to concede, where they state on page 4, and the issue does not arise with such frequency as to command legislative attention. And no, it does not. And where was Case? They were the defendant in the Beard case in 1987, and there has not been one piece of legislation introduced onto the floor of the legislature. And surely they could have found one legislator to do so, if this in fact was an issue. And it is not an issue, and it is not an issue that arises with frequency. And it is something that if the borrowing statute is going to be changed in other time-limiting provisions, such as a statute of repose would be to be read into it, it surely should be something that should be debated in the full form of a legislature where all policy issues can be considered and not the narrow constraints of one case such as this. There is not a case in Wisconsin that we are aware of that has ever held that a statute, a foreign statute of repose, applies in Wisconsin. If this court, for some reason, revisits Leverance and Beard, which is the second reason Stephen Sharp should prevail on choice of law, then we strongly believe that if this court were to do a five-factor analysis under the Heath factors, that on the statute of repose issue, it would come out strongly in favor of Stephen Sharp. On the five-factor analysis, the trial court, the Court of Appeals, did not do a five-factor analysis as to the statute of repose issue. They did it on the damage cap issue and overwhelmingly came out in favor of applying Wisconsin law. I'll only look at one factor so they can move on to other issues, but if we go through the Heath factors, the fourth factor, the advancement of the forum's interest, is the strongest factor that is usually considered by courts doing choice of law analysis. And under that, the policy considerations that this court has articulated for decades are full compensation for victims and deterrence of wrongful conduct. And the Heath court stated, whether victims be residents of this state or if they come from another jurisdiction, they deserve full compensation. Now, we have cited to this court, on footnote 16 of our brief, 9 cases where a plaintiff and the injury were out of state, and the plaintiff's residence was out of state, and the law of the manufacturer's state was applied. In 2 of those 9 cases, Roy and J.B. are five-factor analysis cases, just like this court applies today, the modern view with respect to conflicts of law. And all of the cases that they cite are either a lex loci approach or a substantial factor approach. And so they are really asking this court to go back and do a lex loci analysis in their choice of law argument. Well, then, with the court's permission, move to the inconsistent verdict issue. Even though it was not addressed here, I will address it briefly in the event it may be addressed in reply. Appellants come to this court and they ask this court to overrule 4 cases. We refer to it as an overruling wish list. They come asking this court to overrule Greit, Howes, Fisher, and Giese, which state that there may be recovery for the negligent design of a product even though it is not unreasonably dangerous in the 402A sense.
Counsel, before you continue with this area, I guess I have, for me, an obvious question. You've just given a few minutes presentation on how there's really no conflict in the choice of law. Well, if there's no conflict, then why are you here in Wisconsin trying the case in Wisconsin rather than trying it in Oregon, where apparently the plaintiff lives, it was sold, and where the witnesses would live?
The witnesses, by far, Your Honor, live in Wisconsin who were responsible for the harm. The first 4 witnesses called for purposes of cross-examination under the rules live were North, Johnson, Hartman, and Hayes for 2 weeks of the 6-week trial. And Stephen Sharp was entitled to present those witnesses live to a jury 3 blocks from the court, from the Case Corporation's headquarters, where all of the wrong occurred over a 25-year period of time.
I know, but, you know, you at all oftentimes, as a plaintiff's attorney, I mean, your client's in Oregon, your damage witnesses are in Oregon, your doctors are in Oregon, so who are you going to inconvenience? You're going to inconvenience the manufacturer's witnesses. I mean, that's the way it's done. So why are you doing it in Wisconsin rather than Oregon? Is there another reason other than you want to make the manufacturer's witnesses grant them some convenience?
The very practical reason, Your Honor, is that we were fully aware of the issues in this case as a result of another case in Minnesota that was referenced by the Court of Appeals and the trial court, the Talges case, which was not allowed in evidence, but we represented that plaintiff and knew the testimony from these witnesses and decided that it would absolutely be best to have these witnesses live and not have to put them on videotape to show them to a jury, that we would rather put the medical witnesses on videotape and show them to a jury and let a jury that is three blocks from this manufacturer's headquarters hear the wrongs that have gone on here consciously, conscious inaction, which I'll come to, over a 25-year period of time.
Nothing to do with the statute of repose. Nothing to do with the cap.
Your Honor, when we took the case, we were fully aware of the Erickson case and the post-sale duty to warn. But it is, I think, not in any way incorrect for a trial lawyer to understand the law between two different states and to bring a case in the state that is the best law for a particular plaintiff in the particular case. In fact, I would think it would be malpractice if one didn't. And to come to the manufacturer's state where there's been full knowledge of this, it's not as if we've gone to Illinois and tried to take advantage of a third party state's law in some way. There is absolutely no injustice to Case Corporation for them to be governed by Wisconsin law and to try this case in their very backyard, where I believe 7 to 8 jurors walked off and could not sit in this case because there's no way in the world they could ever render a case, a verdict against the Case Corporation, because 4 generations of people had worked there, and that's in the record as well as a part of the trial of this case. There was no injustice done here by any means to J.I. Case for the trial occurring in that forum. If I may move on then briefly to finish the inconsistent verdict issue. It's important, I think, always to keep in mind that they are the ones who requested a verdict form that had 2 questions combined in strict liability and 2 questions combined in negligence. The trial court and the plaintiffs wanted 4 questions. 1 question on design and warning on strict liability, and then question on design and warning in negligence.
Are you referring to question number 3?
Was
Case Corporation negligent in its design of or warnings accompanying? And the answer was there, yes. Did you ask for 2 questions on question
3? Yes, Your Honor, we did absolutely ask for 2 questions. 1 design, 1 warning on negligence. They insisted that they be combined. The trial court acceded to their wish. Their point was they did not want 4 questions that could possibly one of them be answered against them, so they wanted 2 questions. And now they come to this court, and the Court of Appeals noticed this, with what they call, the Court of Appeals call, and they use their words, speculation on what the jury answered, and there's no way we can speculate on exactly what elements of what cause of action the jury found, or whether they found design in negligence, and no design negligence, but warning negligence, or vice versa, or both. We don't know the answers to those questions, and we can't speculate on them. And the Court of Appeals also chided Case for using selective redaction in the way that they presented the jury instructions in their briefs. And I would point out here this morning in the argument that was made on the post-sale duty to warn, the instruction that was given and the words left out, not when a defect which originated at the time the product was manufactured, it doesn't end there. It says, and was unforeseeable at the point of sale, and is discovered then to present serious hazard. The words, is this was unforeseeable at point of sale, is redacted in their reply brief when they cite this jury instruction. That's the whole point about a post-sale duty to warn negligence verdict, is that, yes, it was back there, pre-sale, but it couldn't be seen. It was then, and it was unforeseeable at that point. They became aware of it at a later time and should do something about it.
Did you just read to us from the jury instruction?
I did read to you from the jury instruction, Your Honor. It was given.
When did Case's post-sale negligence occur?
Your Honor, it occurred over a very long period of time because
in this
sale
case,
here occurs in 1972, and their post-sale negligence begins immediately, and here's why. They had and this also goes to the notice issue, as cited by Judge Mueller on page 18 of her opinion on punitive damages. So I'll address both issues at one time. But in that period of time, and I'll trace all the way up to the point from 92, 69 to 72, and through 73, they were having what's called a clutch plate worker problem, which were a warranty issue, necessitating them to replace clutches, because farmers weren't getting the lever fully forward. They were only moving it a little bit forward, leaving it, and they got engagement. So they needed to do something, and they put a quick fix on. Mr. Johnson, the designer of their lever originally, who had never designed a lever before, he was a Heidelberg, a Simmons draftsperson, went with the responsibility to do the quick fix. He puts the quick fix on with brake springs, he does tip loading, many other things that our experts, Mr. Christofferson, who was the chief design engineer from Toro.
Counsel, excuse me. I guess what I was looking for is a date from which to extend a statute of limitations or a post. So what date is the date you are asserting that there is post-sale negligence?
It begins immediately, and I'm sorry if I went too long into the background. The reason it begins immediately is with that clutch plate warpage problem, they had full notice of a safety issue that should have commanded a redesign at the very moment.
What date did the cause of action accrue for the post-sale negligence?
It accrues and continues every day from 1972 of the sale right up into the time of the accident with Stephen Sharp. Some of the incidents that occurred in there are the Jupe complaint, in which Jupe speaks to a factory representative three times about his tractor self-starting, and he cannot do anything about it, and they never fix it for the entire life of his tractor. But then the next thing happens. In 1986. Now, during this time, they continued to have clutch plate warpage issues and never redesigned the lever. They did a quick fix, but it wasn't adequate. And farmers continued to get the lever hung up on the back edge of the top hat ramp, a top hat ramp that Stephen Sharp had, and that he got hung up on that edge as well in his accident. They then made a change after that on the top hat to a sloped ramp, which never found its way to Stephen Sharp, and no warning about that sloped ramp that there was an improvement ever got to him as well, or anybody that owned his tractor, because they never sent one. And so that's a part of the issue, going all the way up until 1986. And just note that on page 18, Judge Mueller finds this same notice that I'm talking about. Then on 86, Mickey Jones has an accident in which his arm is mangled. And an accident report goes into the company that says, excuse me, there has been a sudden self-start. And that's, the paraphrase is the language, it's in the record, a sudden self-start. And they send Mr. Hartman down to Tennessee to investigate the Jones accident, and Mr. Hartman doesn't know that this lever can start 1/4 inch out of off when he goes. He has no idea that it can happen. He goes down and pushes the lever all the way forward. It starts, pushes it all the way back. It stops, does it 36 times, and goes home. Never has a meeting, never discusses it with anyone. Bud Christofferson from Toro was investigated over 300 accidents. The chief design engineer said that this investigation was pathetic, that they had noticed that there could be other self starts, and in his opinion, it was a matter of if, not a matter of when, another accident would happen, a very serious accident like Mickey Jones, and that this accident to Stephen Sharp should have been prevented. And instead, they came back, had no meeting, never discussed the report. And then Mr. Hayes, who is the person who is responsible for the safety of this product, for the safety of the product, doesn't even know the name of any individual in the Executive Safety Committee, who is the only committee who has responsibility to make a decision on a post-sale issue. He's responsible for the safety of the product. He's never gone into the field, Mr. Hayes, once after the Mickey Jones accident, to look at a tractor, even though they exist at dealerships in and around the Racine area. As Mr. Christofferson did, went to dealerships and looked and investigated and found springs broken in the identical spot that Stephen Sharp's spring was found, in the identical spot that other springs were broken. And I'm only touching on portions of the evidence.
Well, you seem to be touching on a portion of an argument that you haven't said you've gotten to yet, but that is the punitive damages when you go into the facts. So let me ask you a question, because it was prompted by Mr. Frey. Mr. Frey, I'm sorry. Frey, thank you. He said, what more could Case have done beyond the warning that appeared on the tractor? And I read that warning. I think it appears in their brief on page... On page 4, it says the lever must be fully rearward in slot. Stop tractor engine before working. I mean,
what the trial court said, Your Honor, is that the arguments, and this is Judge Mueller, at best, she said, at best, the warning was misleading. The testimony of Mr. Christofferson and Mr. Hinken, an individual who had been hired by Case before, this was the first time he'd ever testified against a manufacturer, a hydraulics expert. They said that the warning wasn't at best misleading. They said it was a lie, an outright lie, because you don't push the lever fully forward to engage. You pull it 1/4 inch out of off, 1/4 inch out of off, and it engages. And when you are turning it off, you don't disengage it by pulling it fully back into the rearward position. You push it back 1/4 inch out of off, and boom. The implement behind you goes off, just like Stephen Sharp's baler went off. He pulled it back, and the baler behind him, making a lot of noise, went off. He gets off to the back to clear something, and it self-starts 2 minutes later, all of which is reproduced on videotapes that are a part of the evidence in this case. So, the...
I'm sorry, maybe I'm not... You seem to be about 2 blocks ahead of me. To disengage, the warning says, to disengage the power takeoff, to disengage the PTO, the lever must be fully rearward in slot.
It's not true, Your Honor. That is absolutely not true. You pull it back, and before you get it to fully rearward, before it goes to fully rearward, about a half inch before going to fully rearward, the implement behind goes off. You don't have to push it fully back. I wish it worked that way. Stephen Sharp would have not had an accident because he would have kept pushing until the implement behind him went off. And when he heard it went off, he thought it was off. It was hung up on the back edge, and for that the jury has adjudged him 35% negligence. And they've hammered and hammered on the fact that he didn't push it all the way back, but he had the implement off. And we had testimony from a human factors expert as well, who also spoke in detail about this warning and said what it should have said, that they should describe exactly how the lever works. But what's incredible here, Your Honor, what's totally incredible, and why our theory of conscious inaction with their head in the sand like an ostrich, which Judge Mueller notes our theory, that went on over a long period of time, is that Mr. North, the chief design engineer, stated in an interrogatory under oath in the Todges case of Minnesota, and this interrogatory was put in evidence, not the name of the case, but the date that he answered the interrogatory, paraphrased, it says, self-starts can't happen. And he said that in that case in 1990. In this case, he took the position that it was open and obvious that it would stop before you got to fully off, and that it would start before you got all the way forward. We called 6 farmers. Every one of them said it was a shock and a surprise when they found out that this could happen to them. They didn't call 1 farmer. He reversed his position in this case and said it was open and obvious, and that it had been designed that way from the very beginning. His credibility was completely shot in front of this jury. And it was also a part, I think, of the conscious inaction and the lying that went on both in this forum in Racine as well as in the forum in Minnesota under oath. And he, very possibly, was confused himself about how the lever worked. Because what was incredible is that Mr. Johnson, the designer of the levers interacting with the hydraulics about 3 feet away, and there are diagrams in our brief, he never looked at the hydraulics or ever talked to anybody who designed it. And when Mr. Johnson, the lever designer, found out that it worked this way that it does, and we showed it to him, and how it worked with animations, he was shocked. He wouldn't want one if it worked that way. It was not how he understood it worked. He understood there was a fail-safe mechanism, that there was something in the hydraulics that would push the lever too off. And of course it didn't, and it didn't for Stephen Sharp. And so Mr. Johnson, and what our experts said is the right hand never talked to the left hand. And that the design process itself, as well as the continuation of the notice that they had after the sale, that their actions were pathetic. That's how it was described by these experts on more than one occasion.
What were what was the specific notice they had and when? Can you give me the...
Specific notice, Your Honor, are the following, if I may. Notice of the Juke complaint. It's in 73. Notice of the multiple clutch problems with lack of full engagement. This is taken from Judge Mueller on page 18. Those went on over a long period of time. They went from 70 to 73 and 74, but they also continued throughout. And our experts said it absolutely was notice of a safety problem, the clutch plate warpage. Number 3 is notice of the inadequate investigation in the Mickey Jones accident that happened in 1986. Something should have been done. It wasn't. Notice that there was not adequate testing of the valve spring, the judge noticed, talked about. Notice that there was no adequate testing of the free travel zone of the lever itself. Notice that there was no testing done of the top hat bracket with respect to the tendency for the plunger to get hung up on the rear. Those were some of the items of notice that she talked about. And then she went on and did a thorough analysis of punitive damages.
When was there no testing? Before it was put on the market or after or both?
Both, Your Honor. And that's the critical testimony, is that there was surely testing of this big tractor, but they could never, ever testify or produce one record that they ever tested the lever. The designer of the lever, Mr. Johnson, very candidly said, I have no knowledge of the lever ever being tested. I didn't test it. Sure, they tested the tractor under field conditions doing this, that, and the other thing, but they never did any hazard analysis on the lever. And then when they had notice that farmers weren't using it properly as they had designed it, is when they did nothing as well. I would just note, if I may, on the inconsistent verdict issue, that we cite to this court 9 cases that span pages 35 to 41 of our brief that note that a finding of no in strict liability and yes in negligence is not an inconsistent verdict. And so when the statement is made here that this state is out of step with the great weight of authority, we disagree, and they've done no great weight of authority analysis. California, Iowa, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Washington, Illinois, Kentucky, Montana, Idaho, Wyoming are where those cases are from. They cite to a comment in the third restatement about a criticism of submitting 2 questions to the jury. But it is not a statement that submitting 2 questions is inconsistent. There's nothing about the restatement that suggests that this verdict is inconsistent. It is a statement that some jurisdictions prefer to submit 1 question, not 2. And also in the third restatement, there is an entire section, not just a comment or a note, but an entire section that addresses post-sale duty to warn issues, and that post-sale cause of action that we are talking about in Oregon and in Wisconsin is absolutely alive and well in the third restatement and completely endorsed. So, unless this court has any further questions of me, I will take a few moments to close and mix one issue to the other issue. And I have a little time left, so I'm pausing if there's anything that I should respond to from anyone. But if not, and of course, you may go beyond my time and ask me questions, but if not, Your Honors, what I would request, on behalf of Stephen Sharp and on behalf of Randall and Betty Sharp, we would request that you not take away the verdict that he achieved in a Racine courtroom in a 6-week trial, that you do not take away his day in court, and that you do not take away his justice, and that no injustice at all has been done to Case here by applying Wisconsin law. And we ask you to be mindful, as I know that you will from many of the decisions of this court, of the inscription in the courthouse that's embedded in the concrete in the Racine courthouse that Stephen Sharp walked under every day, when it said every person is entitled to a certain remedy.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fry.
All right. Let's start with Erickson and Seeley, which is where Mr. Manning started.
You have to stand in front of the microphone so we can pick you up, okay? Thank you.
In Seeley, the footnote says, and Seeley is after Erickson, and it's a decision of the Supreme Court, we express no opinion as to whether a properly pleaded continuing failure to warn would actually state a cause of action independent of the statutory product liability claim. It is an open question in Oregon. Every place else where it's been confronted, the statute of repose has been applied. Now, also in Seeley at page 437, I believe, of Pacific Second, they quote the Oregon statute, and it says the kinds of claims to which the statute applies. 1, any design, inspection, testing, manufacturing, or other defect in a product. 2, any failure to warn regarding a product. The Erickson case was not that kind of case. Now, I would also like to read to the court on the leverage, the effect of the borrowing statute. Let's start with the language of the statute that is supposed to prevent the application of foreign statutes of repose. It says, if an action is brought in this state on a foreign cause of action and the foreign period of limitation which applies has expired, no action may be maintained in this state. Now, Where did that come from? Where it came from was that previous to that time, statutes of limitation were considered procedural. They have to do with when you have to go to court after your cause of action accrues. Statutes of repose, being substantive, have to do with the nature of your right. Statute of repose in Argonne means that there is an element in a product liability case in Argonne that the plaintiff must prove that the product is not more than 8 years old. That is an element. Just as if Argonne required that the plaintiff show a feasible alternative design and Wisconsin didn't, and the plaintiff couldn't show it, and therefore he would lose in Argonne and win in Wisconsin. So what the legislature was doing when they passed the borrowing statute was to say we want to treat statutes of limitation as substantive, the way other things that cut off or limit a plaintiff's rights are treated. And therefore, we're going to say use the statute of limitations of the place where the injury occurred. And we say use the statute of repose of the state whose substantive law governs. And it is not only is it absurd to think that the legislature could secretly, in some secret code that's not there in the statute, have embodied this rule, but it's a very unfair rule to Wisconsin manufacturers because, as Justice Bradley pointed out, if the law were more favorable in Argonne and less favorable in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin manufacturer would be sued in Argonne. So you have a rule that uniquely disadvantages Wisconsin manufacturers. Now, in thinking about the choice of law question, I want you to turn this case around. Suppose you have a product manufactured in Argonne, used for 20 years in Wisconsin, injures a Wisconsin resident, and the Wisconsin resident sues here in this state. You can't tell me for a minute that anybody would say, well, because it was manufactured in Argonne, Argonne has the stronger governmental interest, and we're going to apply the Argonne statute.